Hello, Heartland, Darkland listeners. This is Cassie. I just wanted to give a quick disclaimer before our very first episode. The audio quality of this isn't what we would like it to be. There are some spots that echo a little bit. We're still learning. We're learning this as we go. And next episode, we feel confident the sound quality will be much better, so we hope you'll bear with us and join us again next week for episode 2. And despite the echoey spots, we hope that you enjoy this episode. Thank you, and we'll see you next week. Welcome to Heartland Darkland, our very first episode. I am Cassie.
And I am Shannon.
Thank you guys so much, first of all, for all of the support with just the trailer that we put out. Honestly, it's been amazing. It had a lot more listens than I thought it was going to. Yeah. I figured it was just going to be like our moms and family.
Yep. I know I had to warn my mom, like, this is going to be talking about like graphic murder, but you still have to listen because we need someone to subscribe. So, you know, here we are.
I mean, my mom is the reason I'm into true crime. I grew up on Lifetime and Unsolved Mysteries and America's Most Wanted, all
those
things.
That's amazing. So, I had no idea, actually. I think ever since I've known you, it's been like our conversations have always bonded us over true crime.
I'm pretty sure that's one of the first things we probably talked about.
Because we just sent each other, and to this day, it was like we just sent each other articles of like random, creepy, weird crimes.
Yeah.
Crimes, and then we discuss it. So we're like, why don't we just talk about this with other people?
Yeah. So we decided we'll talk about it. And if people want to listen to us talk about it, fantastic. If it's just our moms, yeah, I guess that's a thing. but this is you know, our new thing that we're trying to do, a little hobby for us. And both of us are from Nebraska, so that's why we're sticking with the Heartland. It's kind of the area we know. And it's not just going to be true crime. We're going to talk about things like cryptids, like Bigfoot, which I just recently found out that I didn't know. I've lived in Nebraska my whole life, and apparently there have been Bigfoot sightings here.
See, that's crazy to me, because I've never, it's funny, because when you say that, I'm like, some of those I need a lot of convincing to believe, because I'm very like, no, not sci-fi, anything like that. So this will be fun, because I think some of these things and stories and stuff that we find will really open my mind to more things out there.
Definitely. Hastings, Nebraska has a Bigfoot Museum, which I grew up near Hastings. I didn't know about this until recently, so I think we need to take a field trip for the podcast sometime.
Yeah. That's fun. Live stream.
You know. And then paranormal, ghost stories, unexplained, you know, UFOs.
See, that's where I'm like, nah, you're going to have to find a good one to convince me on those guys.
I'm going
to
look.
Unless it's E.T. himself walking into my house. I don't know.
I am a believer. I won't lie. So, you know, and that's one of those things, too. We'll discuss at the end, obviously, ways you guys can get a hold of us. But we want to hear your stories, too. You know we can't be the only ones out there who enjoy talking about these things. There's many podcasts, obviously, about them already.
It's all the rage right now.
So we want to hear from you guys, too.
Yeah, tell us about those crimes that happen in your small towns, things that we don't ever, you don't hear about, like in Nebraska alone. So when we first started talking about this, actually, we were like, we could do just Nebraska crimes, you know, because there's actually a lot. And I think that surprises people because it's Nebraska and everyone thinks, you know, everyone's just happy. But it's like, kind of alarming.
The new slogan, it's not for everyone.
Exactly. So we were like, well, here we go. We could start with that. But then the whole Heartland area, there's tons of crime. So I think it's just super intriguing because we are known for being like the nice people or the rednecks, I guess you could say, you know, whatever people want to say. But
that's, yeah. So that's where we're coming from. I mean, I think eventually we would run out of stuff with Nebraska.
Yeah, for sure.
But, you know, even your personal stories, like I've got my own, we'll discuss later on about my own personal, like, paranormal experiences and stuff.
Yeah.
But we want to hear all about you guys. But kind of what our plan for the future of the podcast, and, you know, things can change. But right now, we're just planning on, like, this week Shannon is going to tell us a story about a case. And then next week it'll be my turn. So we're just going to kind of take turns telling each other about these cases that we found and explaining them. So it's like a conversation like we usually would have where it's just us, except this time we decided to record it.
Yeah, because we're funny. Well, we think we're funny. Maybe we're only funny to each other, but...
I mean, probably.
Yeah, I guess today I'm going first. And with that, I wanted to find a crime that was kind of close to home, I guess. So it's a Nebraska crime, first off. Second of all, it's a crime that happened back in like the 80s. So it's not well known because they didn't have half the things back then to, you know, look into things like they do now.
Well, there's not, I mean, social media.
Oh, absolutely. I know, I was like, you know, if back then they would have had cell phones, they could have pinged their location and seen their conversations and knew, you know, like.
Well, and it's crazy. Like, look at what DNA is doing for cases.
I know, all these cold cases.
Oh my goodness. It's amazing.
It is. And it makes me sad that that stuff wasn't available, you know, back when this happened. But I think it's like that with any case, you know. And like this, me telling this story too, it's not necessarily trying to convince you one way or the other if, you know, the, you know, suspect in this case actually did it or not. But it's more of just like giving you the facts and letting you decide for yourself. You can be in the jury box yourself there. So I guess, I mean, I don't know. You ready to just...
Yeah, jump on in. I know a little bit about this case, but I know I was like 6 months old. It took place.
Yeah, you were just a little baby. I, on the other hand, was, you know, two. So I was very mature at the time and knew all the things. No. So, okay, this is back in September of 1988 in Scotts Bluff, Nebraska. So I am from a town nearby, and that is a little small town, kind of just like a suburb, I guess you could say, of Scotts Bluff. So Scotts Bluff is about 15,000 people. So it's not tiny, but it's not huge. But there's a lot of country area out there. So this case takes place out at a farmhouse north of Scotts Bluff, kind of out by a cemetery, actually. So that just adds that extra, you know.
So it's the country of Scotts Bluff, but it's Scotts Bluff.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, that's small town life. You know. Kind of how that stuff goes. And for the sake of, like, I'm sure police jurisdiction and stuff, like, it's country, but the Scotts Bluff
police exactly.
have.
So anyone who's not familiar with Nebraska, just a little background there, it's Scotts Bluff is like in the very, it's like the southwest corner, kind of, you know, the state, the panhandle, they say. You can throw a rock into Wyoming from where Scotts Bluff is. So that kind of just gives you an idea about where it's at. So this was 1988, and we have, let's start with, do you want me to do victims? Do you want me to talk about the victims?
Yeah, I
want to
hear about the victims first.
Okay, so there was Richard Valdez, who was 25 at the time, and then his girlfriend, Sharon Condon, who was 19, and she was also 7 months pregnant with his baby. So they lived in this farmhouse out in the country, and Valdez was known as a drug dealer out there. That's probably part of the reason they lived kind of out there, because I think they had people frequently out there buying drugs. So I think his drugs of choice to deal were marijuana and cocaine. And he...
You know, pretty par for the time, and yeah, marijuana never, you know, goes out of style.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. So they lived out there, and Richard Valdez, we'll just call him Valdez, he would deal to other people. So there was, let me go back to this other guy too. So there was a guy named Ricky Zog, I want to say. Yes. And he was dealing for Valdez. So at this time, this is when Jeff Beaupre kind of enters the picture. So he's been doing cocaine for a while. And it looks like he was fairly well known to law enforcement for small things like, you know, drug things. Nothing violent ever on his history. So that's...
So probably just... Yeah. Probably just more so like possession or public intoxication stuff.
Yeah. I mean, he seems like, you know, he likes to have fun. He likes to party, I guess, right? So
25-year-old in the late 80s.
Yeah, exactly. So he would buy the cocaine he was doing. He would buy that from this Zog character. And so he would get it from him. And that's when Zog was getting it from Valdez. So after a while... he decided that, you know, he wanted to get this from Valdez himself. Like, why?
Cut out the middleman.
Yeah, just cut out the middleman. And so he eventually, after a while, when he knew that Beaupré was kind of okay, Valdez said that Zog could take him, bring him into his home. So he finally let him in after a while. And then that's when Valdez started directly dealing to Beaupré. So Beaupré and Valdez were on decent terms. They had no issues or anything like that up until that point. But Zog did say down the road that after he had met Valdez and Beaupré knew what he had at the house, because he said that Valdez was constantly bragging about all the money he had and the drugs he had on hand. Beaupré had made a joke, about, we should just go take it, all that stuff from him and go in and shoot him. Ha ha. Right. Okay. So he says that obviously nothing happens with that point. So then this is leading up, into the actual crime that took place. So like about, I think it was 1 to 2 months kind of before this all happened, Beaupré had two friends that he was kind of doing drugs with at the time. So Alan Neiman and Kennard Wasmer were their names.
Kennard? Like the town? Names.
What's that?
Like the town Kennard?
Oh, yeah. I was going to say Wisner, but that's like a different town in Nebraska, which is funny because this is Wasmer, but you know. Okay, so yeah, they were buddies. And then at this point, they were all doing cocaine together. And so Beaupré was technically supplying them with the cocaine because he was getting it from his dealer, Valdez. So they would be doing that in the evenings often. So that seemed to be just their hobby once.
I mean, they were partying. Yeah.
They were
25-year-olds.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't sound like any of them were, like, married with kids and full-time jobs.
Not that I was able to find any of that. So
clearly. Yeah. I mean, they're young, partying.
Yeah. I mean, you know, they're just living their best life, I guess, if that's the way you want to play it. So I don't, some of this is hard too, because there wasn't social media. And so there's not a lot of things that go back to that time for me to see, you know, old photos of what they were doing and things. So based off what I've read, it just sounds like they were buddies hanging out, doing drugs together. Because so Kennard Wasmer and then Alan Neiman, those two were roommates. They lived together in a trailer park, you know. Yes, so they lived there, and that's where they would always do the cocaine with Beaupré.
So that was their party place.
Yeah, yeah. So the evening before this crime happened, so September 18th, 1988, Beaupré had cocaine that he had got from Valdez, and this was because Neiman really wanted it. So he had gotten it from him, and they were doing it, like, the whole night, and they went several different times, it says, according to what I've read, that to get more cocaine from Valdez during that time frame. So I don't know enough about cocaine to know what the average amount is that people generally...
I guess, I mean, if you think that if they've been doing it a bunch for a long time, they're probably building up a tolerance to it. And it's probably taking more to get them to that high they want.
Yeah, I guess. So that's what I was like, that's weird, but I don't know. I think, you know, and if they're on drugs, they're high, they probably don't even realize what they're doing.
I mean,
and
it's even like when you're at that point of being tipsy, when you're like, I am invincible and I'm going to be fine tomorrow, so let's keep drinking. And then the next day you hate that past self of yourself. So I wonder if doing coke is the same way.
Mean, I don't know. I guess I can't really say.
Well, just for the sake of our own understanding, we'll say it was something similar to that, and they've built up a tolerance.
Yeah, for
and
sure.
And so they kept going
Perfect.
Back for more.
Because it said that they would often buy a quarter or a half gram at a time, and they would all share it together. So it just sounds like they like to party. So at this point, that's what's happening. So then on September 19th, sometime after midnight that night, Beaupré had made a comment to his buddy, Wasmer, and also take into account, this is what Wasmer's, you know, testimony.
Okay.
So we don't know that this actually happened, but this is what was said, just so everyone's following along here. So he said that Beaupré had made a comment and straight up just asked him if he would go blow away Valdez with him. And Neiman at the time said, no, he said he couldn't ever shoot someone. And he said that Beaupré kept trying to convince him to do it. And he called him a pussy. And he said, fine, if you're not going to do it, then, you know, Wasmer is going to do it with me. So At this point, Wasmer even said, dude, the guy has never done nothing to me. I don't know him. I'm not doing anything to him. So then at this point, Beau Pree's like, whatever, you know, I'm just going to do it myself. So Neiman said that he was trying to talk him out of doing it and that he ran after Beau Pree. Beau Pree leaves the trailer and he's off supposedly to go commit this crime. And this whole time, then after Wasmer went after him, Neiman just stayed there. So then he says that Beau Pree went to Valdez's house yet again. So I'm not sure how many times this is, if this all transpired in the same night or not. So some of these details are a little sketch, which I guess I don't know that it necessarily matters how many times they were there. I guess it's just the point that they were very, like, well-known buyers from him. They were regulars.
Well, and they had been there apparently the night of the murders. They had been there multiple times already. So I suppose Valdez probably wouldn't think anything of it if they're coming back.
Right. Because, you know, and if they're high, like, whatever.
Well, and that's just more money for him.
Yeah, exactly. So then this is when Beau Pree apparently goes back to where he lives, which is at his father's house. And he changes his clothes, grabs a gun that he had purchased forever ago, whatever. I don't know where the gun came from, but
it's Nebraska country, right, in the 80s.
That's fair. That's a fair assessment. So then he goes to Valdez's door, pounds on the door, and he says, Valdez says, you know, who is it? And then at this point, this is when they claim that the door opened, and then this would have been, let's see, I think, was it Neiman that went with him? And they were there, or Wasmer. So, let's see. No, it would have been Neiman. That's right. I'm sorry. There's so many names here. I'm like, yeah, so many drugs, so many people doing drugs. Okay, so then Neiman was with him, and he claims that when he was waiting in the car, when he heard, you know, the door open, and he heard someone screaming, oh God, oh shit. And so then Beau Pree jumps. He said he just saw Beau Pree jump, and he heard a bunch of shots. And so at this point, Neiman claims that he went into the house, and when he went in, he found Valdez lying on his back, and he had been shot several times, and he saw him roll over onto his side. So, you know, at this point, he says he goes back, he leaves, and then Beau Pree came out with blood, and then he said, there can't be any witnesses. And so then he goes back in, and this is when Neiman said he heard a woman screaming. And at this point, then he hears several more shots fired. Okay, so this is where it gets kind of weird.
Wouldn't she have heard the gunshots originally and been screaming prior?
Right. So, like, if it was in the middle, not the middle of the night, but I mean, they make it sound like it's just in the early hours of the morning or whatever. I think, and if she's, you know, 7 months pregnant, she's sleeping. Because I know that they found her in the bedroom later, so. But still, you would wake up to that, right?
You would think. I mean, I guess she could have been a...
And I don't know the amount of time in between shots. And, like, nobody can really say.
True. But my thing is, it seems to me, it sounds weird for him to have left and then, like, walked out and then come back
right
in. Like,
I know.
It feels like it would have had to have been a consecutive thing.
Well, and that's why it's weird. This is where it's like, okay, this Neiman character, also, like, how credible is he if he was high at the time? You know, like, so this is all kind of according to him. So this is, like, the layout of the story. I mean, evidence will speak for itself. But so he says then that he, you know, he hears her screaming. He hears all these shots. Then Beau Pree comes out of the house. He has several items with him. Then he goes back in and he knocks out the light with a hammer. Not sure necessarily what that prevents. I don't know. I thought that was a weird fact that I read. And I was like, what's the reasoning behind that? Yep. Not sure. It's like someone's going to find him whether the light's on or not. I mean,
yeah. Well, I guess if you're high, who knows what your thought process is.
Yeah, that's so true. So then he says that he gets back in the car and he says to Neiman, you should have seen it. That bitch pled for her life. And yeah, like super just heartless. So then, you know, he was not covered in blood, but they said they specifically made a comment that there was blood on his jeans. So that kind of comes into play later on. But there was blood on his jeans and he had taken her purse at the time, because he had said that that's all he, you know, could get or whatever. So they get back, he goes and opens up the purse, and there's $1,700 in there. And he makes a comment about, well, that's not bad for killing two people. But that's it. So, like, prior to that, the fact that Valdez had bragged about having tons of money, firearms, and drugs all in the house.
I mean, because it sounds like he's almost a supplier for other dealers.
Yeah.
He's like the top of the pyramid scheme of the drug dealing.
Yeah. And he was young, too. I mean, like, I don't know. It's just crazy to me, because if you're going in there and that's the MO, then why...
If you're
Do
going
you leave
because,
with just that?
Yeah.
That's why I'm like, was he not in the right state of mind either?
Well, yeah, I mean, if they're that high, no. But $1,700, even in the late 80s, it's not like that's going to be a huge amount of money.
Not at all. And like with that money, then he suggests that they should go down to Arizona and use the money that they have to buy more cocaine so they can distribute it here, or not, well, not here, but you know, when they come back, they're going to do that. So he wants to go do that. And I don't know how he talks these dudes into doing this, because they're okay, let's go. So they get on the road, they start heading to Arizona. So on their way there, supposedly Beaupre was talking about wanting to hit up other, like, you know, gas stations on the way and wanting to rob them so they could have more money, and that he was on a high from killing them and he just wanted to kill more people. And then this is at the time that Wasmer said that he did not, like, he just wasn't comfortable with that and he wasn't sure what he was going to do. So he dismantles the gun, and somewhere around New Mexico, they decide that they should probably get rid of the gun because it's, you know, evidence. So they get out, they watch Beaupre walk out a distance, throw the different pieces into like a ravine, and it's kind of just a big muddy mess. So they ditch the gun, and this part comes into play later on because it's pretty significant to the evidence. So they do that, and they end up, I don't know that they necessarily went and got more drugs with that, because I'm sorry, that probably would pay for gas and food. Like, what else to go down there are you gonna do? I think they were just on a high at that point. And so I think, so I don't know, whatever it is, you know, then they come back and they're back in town, and then Beaupre, you know, hears that they find these bodies. So he turns himself in because he heard that there was a warrant for his arrest. So then we go back to the crime scene, and this is where they had found their bodies. So they both died. You know, unfortunately, there were 4 shells and 7 bullets that they found around and in Valdez, and then Condon was found in the bedroom, and she was shot. It's like sickening to me, and it feels very personal, because she was shot in the face. She was shot 6 different times, and they said that the shots were in her head, chest, arms, and that she actually died from the instant shot to her head. And
so she died instantly.
And she was, it said that the gun was fired from 3 feet away. So, I mean, to me, that's very personal.
It sounds like she was the target, not Valdez.
Right. And I did read some things, too, that said that they never ran a sexual assault kit or anything on her, because there didn't seem to be any evidence that supported that, which, okay. But
it's weird. Wouldn't you cover all your bases?
I know. This was also like the 80s. And I mean, so to me, true. I'm like, oh my gosh, nowadays
Nebraska,
that would never
like
fly.
Small town Nebraska,
yeah, yeah.
Too.
Oh, yeah.
Probably aren't the right. most used to murders.
I know. Because, and that's the thing. I think that, like, being in a small town, the law enforcement was probably just over their heads anyways. I mean, I'm sorry, but nothing like that happens in a small town. Or it shouldn't. You know, you don't think
it
will.
I mean, it does. It's one of those things that...
Oh, yes. And I think, you know, they were well aware. I feel like when there's people like that in the community, in a small community, that are dealing drugs, it's not like a big secret to most people.
Oh, no.
And so I'm sure, you know, they thought just a drug deal gone wrong, which in this case, maybe it was, but it was bizarre then, because this is where it gets crazy. This is like stuff that you hear in movies or you read about in a book. The reason that they actually suspected Beaupre was because Valdez, next to his body, in his blood, he wrote Jeff, and then he wrote Beaupre. And there was it was a mix of blood and then also like grease, like automotive grease. He had a tube of that in his pocket, and it was also on the counter. So the thing that's like super sketch to me is how, well, I just don't understand how he would write that. But they said that he was shot in his chest, at an abdomen, and his left arm. So according to that, a pathologist said you can technically live for up to 15 minutes after that kind of a wound before you die. So he could have been capable of doing that. Did he? I don't know. So
I would be curious to know if there was like any sort of like drag marks of his blood or something.
Yes, that's where I get real confused, and it's very difficult to find some of this information online, which also feels sketchy to me. I think some of that, it's like, okay, small town, it's not like they just have all the archives from the 80s.
Right. You'd have to actually probably like
go to the
town.
Well, and some of that stuff too, I don't think that they necessarily like
made public.
Yeah. Which, okay, I think it was just sketchy, the fact that he did that, because then I read different things about the autopsy report that said, based on the angle he was found and the lividity of his blood, you know, like how the blood settled and all that, he wouldn't have been able to turn.
Like how your blood settles after you're dead.
Yes.
Your heart stops pumping.
Yes.
Okay. And I know there's some other true crime podcasts.
You know, and I'm just also saying I'm not an expert on any of this. Like,
for sure. Yeah. Disclaimer that we should have put at the beginning.
Disclaimer, yes.
We are not experts in
this.
This
is us talking
stuff.
It out. Okay. So I don't want to hear anything about, how can you say that? I'm not blaming anybody in this case. I'm not blaming law enforcement. I think that there's a lot of people that did their jobs well. I think there's a lot of people that probably weren't trained, especially in a small town when you don't have means to do all the different things to train. I won't speak on that. So I think it got a little crazy because they find his name written in the blood. So, you know, he's arrested. Okay, duh. That would be the first thing. Like, if they found my name, yeah, they're going to come arrest me. I mean, why wouldn't you, right? Or question him. At least take him in for
question. I wonder if that would be enough for an arrest warrant, though.
So then
today,
it's like,
I don't know that that would still be enough.
I know.
It was the 80s, so who knows?
Once again, they're probably like grasping at straws. We have to start somewhere. Let's just bring this dude in. So, you know, because then I think, okay, well, if he didn't do it, then did someone else want to frame him that was there after the fact and didn't like him? I don't know. It could go a lot of different ways at that point. So that was kind of weird, I think,
so then
alone.
Beaufrey turned himself in
because
he heard.
There was a warrant out for his arrest
because of the name being written.
Correct. Okay. He immediately said, you know, he was innocent. He had nothing to do with this. He was associated with Valdez because of the drug use. And he did say that. But other than that, he has still remained, you know, innocent, or he claims his innocence.
Still maintains his innocence.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't know. And does that mean, I don't know that that necessarily means anything either, because some people
won't ever own up.
Yeah. So I don't know. So then at that point, it's like they have him. So it's an easy target, right? So you have that. They then at this point, I think, you know, Neiman and Wasmer get, you know, brought in and questioned too. So at some point, you know, they're going to say, hey, if you just tell us what happened, we won't.
We've all seen.
Yes, and that's how
you
it
know,
goes.
So different interrogation videos and the things like that, the tactics they use. Like, first of all, not trying to tell people to get away with murder. But you don't have to talk if you're not under arrest.
Right.
You can
I
leave.
Know. Turns out, guys, you don't have to do what they say.
And even if you're under arrest, you still don't have to talk. You can ask for a lawyer, and they cannot question you anymore after that. Again, not trying to tell people how to do things. But I mean, I also think that's something that people kind of need to know for basic things. Like, that's a good thing to know. I think we get to the point where, as people, we're like, well, these are the police, and if we're innocent, we just need to tell them. But that's not always the case.
I know.
You know? And that's not even saying like, oh, a bad cop framing someone. That's just saying how things fall together sometimes, you know. I'm not going to go off on any tangents one way or the other, but I think just for people's own self-awareness and protecting themselves,
don't speak until, and just because, even if you didn't do it, I think people are so quick to be like, I didn't do it, so why would I even say I'm not gonna talk? But
I feel like that's a double-edged sword, because like people are like, well, if you're innocent, then why wouldn't you talk? Why would you ask for a lawyer? But at the same time, then if you talk, then people are like, why didn't you ask for a lawyer?
It's like, because I watch TV and I watch movies, okay? I plead the fifth.
Listen, yeah. Listen,
I don't know what it is, but I plead the fifth.
Okay? Listen, at this point, I've watched a lot of true crime, listen to all the true crime. I'm not talking without a lawyer. Am I under arrest? No, then peace out.
Okay, we know what goes on behind the scenes. Oh my gosh, that's...
I watched How to Get Away with Murder,
1,000%, yes. And also, don't get your murder advice from that show, and just don't kill anybody, probably.
I mean, they killed so many people. Okay, but we're off now. Yeah, let's go back.
This is like, there's so many different things, moving parts of this story, that it's kind of hard to just like, there's not a direct timeline. So at this point, though.
So now both friends are being interviewed.
And they're both being told, you know, hey, we know you had something to do
with
this.
There's probably scare tactics being used at this.
So they were able to tell the officers, investigators, whatever, exactly where this gun was dropped, where they left it. They actually went with investigators to the scene, and they found that gun.
Did they find all the parts?
Not all the parts, but they found enough that matched, you know, the same, you know, bullets and shell casings from the crime scene. So
that ballistics on shell, that's a whole other thing. Right. To like, that's not a exact science, but yes.
Yeah, exactly.
So the bullets matched the gun.
Yes.
Like, these are the bullets that would be used in this type of gun.
Yes, exactly. So that happens. So there's a tie there now. So they can tie him to that, other than the fact, too, that his name is written in blood. Okay, that's sketchy. So with that, too, this random fact of the story, which I found so weird to me, after this whole thing happened, and, you know, and they're interviewing to Valdez's family, you know, and they're asking them if they're, you know, anything they know, the dad, Valdez's dad, specifically says, well, my son told me if he was ever murdered, he would write the person's name in blood.
Who said
that?
Okay,
what kind of statement is that? Like, good job, son. I'm proud of you for...
The only thing I've talked to, like, I've talked to my mom about, like, if I die, I will come and haunt you. I'm like, not haunt, but I will, like, come to you as a spirit so you know I'm there. And, like, these are these signs. But I've never been, like, if I'm murdered, my murderers... Because also, how do you know?
No!
Yes! Like, I mean, you don't...
Yeah, how do you know that? Like, I thought that was such a specific...
There's so many ways for a person to kill you. You don't know. What if you were sleeping? What if they poisoned you?
I know. And it was a very specific thing to say, you know, and directly related to the case. Okay, so is that... Well, and it's like, is the dad saying that after the fact because he really wants to be like, no, my son did that, you know? I get, like...
Okay, so I guess I'm a little cynical and I'm like, the dad did it then. But I mean, then you, the parent, as a parent, I could see wanting... Being a parent myself,
justice.
I could see wanting to think, okay, yes, this was my son. We know who did it. So it doesn't become this long, dragged out thing of like, who would do this to my child? So, okay, I guess I'll give him the
book. I know. And I just, it was like, you want justice and you want to believe your kid would know what to do in that case. But also, if I go missing, you better believe, like, hell, I will fight. You just check under my fingernails. I'm going to do something to get some DNA in there. But I think that was a weird thing. But also, prior to this, too, they both had made statements to their family, just kind of in, you know, normal conversation, that they were afraid that someone was out to get them.
Well, I mean, being a drug dealer and being that high up, like,
watch your back all the time.
No kidding. Especially being that close to the state line.
Yeah.
I mean, there's got to be all sorts of things.
I know. I mean,
and how did they, okay, so like Beaupre and his friends, how did they decide to go to Arizona for the drugs? Like, did Valdez say that's where his supply came?
I have no idea.
So that's what I'm curious about there too. But so Valdez has to be getting his drugs from someone.
Mm-hmm.
And
there's always someone higher up.
Right. So I'm wondering, so like, that doesn't seem weird to me that they were worried.
Right. I think when you're in that kind of business, not that I know, you know, but I'm like,
you have to have some paranoia.
You know. Oh, absolutely. And you never know who's going to snitch on you and all that. And so they were actually, prior to this, they were in the process of getting ready to move to Texas. So not sure exactly what the ties there were, but they wanted to get away from Scott's Bluff. And Sharon Condon, sorry, I was like, to go back to her, she actually had said something to her family too about if someone killed Valdez, they would have to kill her too. And this was a couple weeks prior to this. So
she's like a ride or die. And
oh yeah.
Okay, but at that point too, it's like you have another human growing in you. I'd be like, sorry, dude.
Yeah. And she was 19. Like, that is so young.
But then also 19-year-old brains are like, oh my God, for the best. And I can't say much, but I mean.
I mean, right.
We've all been there, and I get it. Like, everything is the end of, you know, your whole world then at that point. And I think especially being in that lifestyle, like, I kind of wonder if she had the whole, like, oh, we're Bonnie and Clyde. And
I know. Well, yeah, and it seems like. I mean, if he really did have, well, he did have that amount of cash. I mean, he was sitting pretty cushy. So that was another thing.
The main drug dealer in a small town where there's nothing to do. I bet he was rolling in the money.
Hey, there are things to do, okay? No, I'm just kidding. There's actually.
Listen, I grew up in a small town. I know that there's nothing to do in a small town.
Yes. So, yeah, I think it gets weird, too, because supposedly the motive for this whole thing was the money and the drugs, right? So when the cops are, you know, investigating, they're at the crime scene, they find over $10,000 cash, firearms, and a ton of drugs. So if that really was the motive, why did whoever did it leave it all, you know?
Right. Why wouldn't you have, I mean, both people are incapacitated or dead. Why wouldn't you search the place? Especially because it's not like you had neighbors.
Right.
You had to worry about hearing all of this.
And you went there 9,000 times a night, apparently, right?
You'd have to know at least kind of, like, I'm assuming a drug dealer is going to be, I don't even know. I guess, like, you'd be somewhat suspect about, like, where, like, you wouldn't let people see where you keep your stash.
Right.
But then again, it sounds like this guy was a braggart, not to speak ill of the deceased and the victim, but it sounds like he talked about stuff.
Proud of what he did, and he was proud of.
It doesn't seem like something where it seems more like he would have it out and about. And granted, if they were in bed and not expecting more deals, like maybe he had it stashed somewhere. But again, I don't get why you wouldn't search. Like, you have no reason not to. You don't have neighbors who are going to call the cops. You don't have someone tied up who could get loose or something, or is hiding. You don't know where they went. I mean, there's no reason not to search the place for these things if that was your sole motive for killing these two people.
So then it makes you think, what, did they have an argument? Did he just have the gun with him to protect himself? And if, you know, a fight broke out and it was more of like just in the moment, heat of the moment, who knows? I mean, no one really knows except for whoever was there. And so Neiman, you know, claimed that he actually saw Beaupré kill Valdez and that he bragged about killing Condon. And so all of that kind of sealed the deal for Beaupré.
Well, when you have, when you have an eyewitness.
So they, you know, they go to court for this. So this was back, you know, after it happened. And it was just a whole thing. I mean, so Beaupré definitely fits the frame of a prime suspect. He, you know, the fact that he was a drug user. They have video of him flipping off the news crews as they're filming him being, you know.
So he was antagonistic.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, he's pissed, you know, whatever. But the story, it just becomes its own perfect storm, really, because there's so many more layers to the story that I don't think even began to get unraveled in the story. And it seems kind of like, not that it was like a convenient conviction, because I don't necessarily know that. And I think it's very likely that Beaupré is guilty and did it. But I also think that it's interesting that not all the details about the evidence were brought up or brought like in discovery. They never brought them into discovery for court. So I actually had talked to a juror who was on that case, and he had said that, you know, it was just such a crazy thing, first of all, to even be a part of, because nothing like that happened there, and that it was very scary, and they actually ended up being sequestered towards the end of the trial because it was so, you know, such a big thing, and
like
they didn't want them.
Sensation or everything.
Yeah. Man. And he said he was a runner at the time, and he was running out there. There's kind of like a big landmark, like the Scottsbluff National Monument. It's kind of out by itself. It's beautiful, but that's neither here nor there. So there's trails, like running trails out there. And he would run early in the morning. And he said one time he felt there was a car following him, trying to scare him.
Oh.
Yeah. And so, like, a lot of things like that, which who knows what side that would have been on or right. for, but he said he just felt very, like, unsafe, you know, and it definitely haunts, I think, a lot of these people to this day, because that's such a big thing. And all the evidence they were shown in the trial led them to believe that he was guilty. So he said that when they first went back to deliberate, you know, they said, let's just start with who thinks he, you know, didn't do it. And he said, everybody except for like two people raised their hand. He said, okay, this is a good starting point. So we know where we're at. He said, you know, we took this so serious. This was someone's life. And so he said they went through every piece of evidence that they were presented, yeah. which a couple of the things they went off of are Neiman and Wasmer's testimonies. Okay, I'm sorry. They're also cokeheads. So
why? Well, they were at the very least high as well.
And right.
their judgment and their memories impaired. But then too, like, did they get something out of testifying?
Sure did. Because so they both testified, right? And, you know, saying that they saw him do it and all of that. And so they were offered, you know,
like plea deals.
Yeah. So Wasmer actually ended up getting nothing. He claimed that he was never there and he had no part of it. How he wasn't charged as some sort of accomplice or get... Yeah. Nope. He never got charged.
That seems weird. Like, yes. No accessory after the fact or anything?
Nothing. So that's what's... There's so many red flags about this case. And I just don't... I mean, you could spend so much time really digging through this whole thing and never really understanding it, because then Neiman got charged with robbery. So they gave him a lesser sentence and he only served 3 to 4 years. But then this is where it gets, I mean, interesting. After the fact, then he recanted his testimony. He said that he was coached through it and promised things if he testified to what they wanted him to say.
Oh my goodness.
Okay, so that's beyond sketchy. And so then, you know, they really went off of the jury had those testimonies. They said the one thing that really kind of sealed the deal for them was the fact the testimony of them going and finding the gun and being able to say, this is right where the gun was.
Right.
And it was linked to him directly. He had a connection with Valdez. I mean, that, you know, it was so long ago that the juror didn't remember a lot of minimal details, but
I mean, that's such a big thing. Like, if they're saying this is the murder weapon,
mm-hmm.
how do you not be like, okay, well then if his two friends did this, they were able to take the police there and they're saying this, I could definitely see how if this is the evidence you have,
right,
you'd be like, yeah, he totally did it.
Yeah.
But nowadays, I would sit there and look at it and be like, okay, well, one, it's small town Nebraska where everyone probably has similar guns.
Yeah.
And then two, if they went to New Mexico or on their way there or to Arizona and they ended up in New Mexico in a drug-fueled state, who knows why they decided to leave the gun there? And I'm not saying that I think he's innocent, but I'm trying to play the other side. Look at the
devil's advocate. Yeah,
you know, of being like, okay, well, what other? But I could see how if that's the evidence that they're given,
based off what they were given, I think they made the right choice.
Yeah.
I would have probably thought the same thing.
Okay, so before we get into like some of the other stuff that leads us to, because I know there is some questionable stuff then that we find out later on afterwards. What is Jeff Beaupre? Is he found guilty? What's he convicted
he's
of?
He's found guilty of two life sentences. So
okay.
He serves two life sentences. So but he was found
to sentenced two life sentences.
Yeah.
Because of course at that point, which I know is still kind of a thing where infants, they're like still back and forth on whether or not that's considered a murder. I don't know the full details. I know nowadays that's still a thing.
Yeah.
So 88, they're not like...
He only got charged with two. Yeah.
Yeah. Although, again, small town Nebraska, I'm kind of surprised at that. But we're not going to go into
that's
a whole other thing, yes. A whole other podcast.
Oh, yeah.
So that's interesting. So he, based on that evidence, that's convicted and he's still serving that, right?
Yep. I actually spent a ton of time looking him up, you know, and seeing. So he is serving, you know, he's still in there. He still is claiming his innocence. He has appealed so many times, so many different things. He has been denied a new trial. You know, I mean, he's played every card you can play at this point, you know, and he's not getting any younger. And I think at this point, It's sad. The whole thing is sad no matter what, because it seems, you know, it was something that could have been easily prevented. But he, I mean, has brought new evidence, DNA things that haven't brought.
Well, now with DNA, that's just it. Like, we have all this DNA now. Like, are they going to test any of the DNA?
So that's another thing. So one of the things that got brought up after the fact was they found DNA and some blood on the front of Valdez's house, like at the front of his door.
Like, the murderer probably had cut themselves, injured themselves possibly.
Yes. So that turns out that was the DNA that was actually connected to Condon's cousin. Oh. And last name, Yellow Boy.
His last name was Yellow Boy? Yeah. That sounds like a weird nickname.
I know. Like, that's his actual
last name, Yellow Boy.
And so it was her cousin, and there were people, he's currently serving time in Colorado right now. He's serving a 66-year sentence for a rape and kidnap.
So his DNA is in the system.
Right. So then people are like, okay, well, was he there, though, because it's her cousin? How old was that? You know, like that whole thing. They tried to, you know, play that card. Nothing happened with that, which I think, why, maybe it was investigated more and we just didn't hear, but I still find that a bit odd as well. So that happened. And then another thing that Beaupre had brought up was the jeans. So, you know, they mentioned he had blood on his jeans. Right. So those jeans were at the trailer of Wasmer and Neiman, and they found the blood, but they never brought that to court as part of their evidence? No. And so his whole thing is, it was Condon's blood, but the jeans, he was saying they never looked at the jeans. They were a size 40 jeans. He said, that is not the size I would wear. Those would never stay up on me. Why was that never taken into consideration, that one of, you know, Wasmer or Neiman would have had those jeans on? Yeah. And that places them directly at the crime scene.
Right.
And so that was another thing that got brought up that was never shown. I've seen pictures of the crime scene being contaminated where law enforcement was there, and you can see fast food bags and stuff out at the crime scene.
Oh my goodness. Again, but that's where we come back to the small town not knowing what to do.
And like, that's the thing too. I don't want to like point fingers and say they did it wrong, because I don't even know where I stand with this. I'll just say that I went into this,
I don't know that thinking, they intentionally did it wrong.
Yeah. I thought, you know, 100% guilt. The juror that I had spoke with, I mean, pretty much said that there was no doubt in his mind that he was guilty, you know? And so I went into that thinking like, yeah, he obviously did this. This is kind of silly that he's even trying to get out of it. But then the more that I like read the evidence, read different stories and peeled it back, I'm not so convinced now, you know?
Yeah.
And I mean, to me, I think like, was it just a convenient thing? Cause then there was rumors back then that one of the lead detectives, I believe, who went on to be a judge or something, was also involved in a drug ring around there. So that's where, you could go down the rabbit hole,
theories and stuff around that.
But it's just crazy to me. And so I don't know if I tried to get in touch with some of the family of Valdez, and I was unable to do that. But I would be curious to see if they feel like justice was served and if they feel that the right person is behind bars.
Yeah, that would be interesting. But I also think that as the victim's family, you want to believe that it was. Like, you don't want to think that the wrong person, because then that's
no closure for you. Yeah.
Your family didn't get justice, but now someone else. Mm-hmm. You know, that would be such a difficult, I can't even imagine being in their shoes with that. But I'm curious, I'd be curious to know if the Innocence Project has taken a look at Beaupre's case, if he's gotten a hold of them, because I know sometimes they'll help with this kind of stuff.
I believe so. I mean, there's actually a ton of different groups you can follow that do believe his innocence, you know, and you can find about everything you want about it. I mean, most people who have read all the things are not so convinced. I mean, he's the perfect suspect. He kind of fits all the different, you know, checks all the boxes, but like, I don't know. And now it's like so weird to see him as this, not old man, but older man, you know, because I've, you know, seen the pictures of him. I'm like, it's hard to look at him and think that guy would do that, you know, because you see him as a sweeter old man. Yeah. And he does, he trains dogs, apparently, and does, because I found some of that on the internet. There, he has videos out there. Oh. And I don't even know. And maybe, like, you know, if he did do it, I hope he is really, I mean, you know, changed as a person, but he still claims his innocence. At this point, wouldn't you be like, okay, fine, I did it. Like, you're already serving the rest of your life. I don't know.
I don't know if you're still trying to get out, though.
I know. That is true.
The hope of getting out and, like, then getting money on top of that or something. Because if you're wrongly convicted, you're getting money.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
I would hope.
But it's interesting that he keeps being denied, you know, all of the things. And he appeals and appeals. And so that's where it just gets weird. Because, I mean, you could really...
I feel like this is something that you could go on and on about. Mm-hmm. Like, that's such an interesting case. And that is the hard thing about some of these older cases. I know when I was looking up before we even started, I found this case from, like, early 1900s that I really wanted to do. But all I found was an old 1900 mm-hmm. newspaper. And I was like, one, mm-hmm. I have horrible eyes to begin with. Trying to read this, nope. Oh. And it didn't have the information I needed and stuff. And that was, I mean... This is nice, though, and I think, you know, too, for our listeners to kind of know, like, some of these cases, like, we're going to do our best to get the facts and the research we have, and, like, obviously, if you guys know something, we're open to constructive criticism. Like, please don't be rude.
Yeah, like, come on, we're still
cool. You know, if there's something you're like, hey, you got this completely wrong, like, we want to know, and we'll correct ourselves, but we're going to do the best we can with these cases. Get as much information as we can. And sometimes it might not be a ton, but I think, like, this is a case that, like, where it was hard to research, I think it's still good to know. It's good to show, like, hey, this seemed black and white, but guess what? It's not. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think going forward, you know, like I said, I mean, we're going to do the best we can with this. And obviously, you know, even too, like, if you're like, hey, actually, did you guys know this? Like, if you have more information that maybe... Yeah. isn't easily found, but from a reputable source or something, you know, we're interested in that stuff too.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, yeah, like, well, there'll be, we're gonna post some pictures today on our social media sites.
So when this gets posted, we'll have, like, a few pictures and stuff from the case that we post to our socials, which, speaking of, let's just plug those real fast.
Yes.
So we're Heartland Darkland Podcast on Facebook, Heartland Darkland Podcast on Instagram, and we're at HL_DL Podcast on Twitter. Again, it'll still be Heartland Darkland. You'll see all of our stuff. But again, too, like, if you want to contact us, if you have more information,
questions. Yes. If there's corrections, we are more than happy to.
Yeah,
give those shots.
We're new at this. We're learning this as we go. So, you know, we're going to improve. We're going to get better. We're going to do better. But I think, you know, this is our first time and we're just two people who like to talk to each other. And we decided other people should hear us talk too. But yeah, so then also you can email us at heartland.darklandpodcast@gmail.com. And we'll link these in the show notes and stuff too, at least the email. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think that's one of the things we got. Like, that's where we're at. I feel like we've talked a lot.
We'd love to hear from you. If you enjoyed this, invite your friends.
I always hear them say, leave a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. Apparently, that's a big deal. Mm-hmm. We're not sure why.
We don't know. We're right now in a basement recording on a janky card table. So,
I mean, listen, we're doing what we
can. You know, you got to start somewhere.
Right. So please like, subscribe, leave a review, all the things. But now then, I guess until next week.
Yeah, I mean, we'll be back.
Yeah, every Wednesday. So we're trying to load these every Wednesday now.
Yeah, so... You know, yeah, and if there's some cases you want us to look into...
Yeah, email us. Yeah. Be like, and just put for the subject line, podcast story idea or whatever. Or again, if you have your own experiences, if you have a great UFO alien experience that we can convince Shannon...
You're going to have to take a lot of convincing.
Or paranormal. I mean, it doesn't have... But right, it doesn't have to be true crime. All the things...
Yeah. any mystery things. There's so many random places you hear stories about weird things happening.
But we are looking to be within the Heartland states.
Yes.
Which I'm not going to lie to you. I can't name them all off the top of my head right now. But if you Google it, they're
Midwest,
there.
Just think Midwest area.
You know, I know Minnesota.
If you're in the Midwest area, you know.
You know. But then until next week, then, be Heartland kind.
But Darkland wary.